It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, in our Food Friday segment, we'll discuss how to make a salad hearty and yummy enough to be considered a main course. But first, the police shooting of an unarmed black teen in Ferguson, Missouri last week has highlighted the frustrations of some African-American communities over what they describe as unequal treatment by police. Protesters have written the words "Black Men Matter" on the pavement in Ferguson, and voices from the African-American community have begun speaking up about the experience of being a black man in America and what it means to prepare African-American children for a world that might view them with suspicion. Joining us now is Dr. Alex G., head of the Justified Anger Coalition. He's also the founder of a nonprofit community empowerment program called Nehemiah and senior pastor of Fountain of Life Church. Pastor G., welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what did you think when you heard about the shooting of Michael Brown last week? What went through your mind?
I thought a couple of things. I thought, that poor mom, that family, that young man. And the second thought was, here we go again. Sadly, that was what I thought. Here we go again. And thirdly, at what point are we going to begin to really assess the value of the life of African-American men?
It's an interesting point, one that has been taken up by yourself and by others. As I said in the introduction, in Ferguson, protesters have been writing phrases like "Black Men Matter" on the sidewalks, and that is one theme that is emerging here. As a society, do we devalue black men as you see it?
I think so. I think we do. I mean, obviously. Now, I mean, what I'm about to suggest is hypothetical, of course, but I just... You know, in the black community, we will witness a situation, and then we will try to juxtapose it with the black reality. So I ask myself, if a black cop had shot an unarmed white gentleman, would we have known his name by now? We would have known, in my opinion, his name, his family's name, his background, what his grandmother did for a living, where his kids went to school, whether or not his kids dropped out. We'd know everything about their family. And so when I look at the treatment of this situation, nothing of it resembles a value of the life of a black male. I'm not saying that everyone discards it, but I'm saying it is certainly not valued the same way an 18-year-old unarmed college freshman white male would be valued.
James Causey of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently wrote a piece about how parents have to prepare their sons to go out into the world as African-American men. Things like how to behave around police to keep their hands within view, how to handle suspicion in a store and to expect it. Is this something that you think some African-American families are reading and looking at each other and nodding?
Oh, of course. I mean, this isn't even extracurricular. This is right up there with wash your hands after going to the bathroom, ask to be excused from the table, say yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. When the police pull you over, keep your hands at 10 and 2. I'm 50 years old, and I do that. When I'm pulled over, I was pulled over a couple of years ago in front of our church door, and I was infuriated. I was embarrassed. My white associate was in the same parking lot waiting for me. In fact, he was the only car there. And when I arrived, the police pulled me over and started asking questions. I knew that I had the chief of police on speed dial. I knew that I had friends in the department. I knew that there were officers who were members and leaders in my church. But the fact that if I acted frustrated or as angry as if I presented my level of anger, that I would somehow seem to be acquiescing to a level of guilt, culpability, and my actions could be misread. And so as a grown man with an advanced degree, and I'm from this community and have served this community, I still want to make sure that I am above suspicion when I'm stopped. So, of course, that comes way back from training. In fact, my white associate got out of his car and walked over to my car while I was being questioned, and I thought, and I laughed to myself, I said, I can tell that he's not a black male, because as much as I care for him, black men are taught, you do not get out of your car while a police officer stops someone else and walk up on them. Not because you're going to get shot if you do that, and that's not what I'm suspicious of in Madison. But it goes through your mind because it happens in places, and the fact that when I'm stopped, I want a camera on. I want to dial someone on speakerphone. Just last week, I told my daughter, who's a 17-year-old young lady, if you're pulled over by the police, if you're driving, Put your hazards on so they know that they see you, but drive to a well-lit area. Do not pull over on a side road where it's dark and no one's around. Put your flasher on, call 911 to let them know, hey, I'm being pulled over, but I'm pulling into a gas station. But I had this conversation with my daughter last week. I would have told my son if I had one even more than that.
Now, those are conversations you're talking about that I expect are not common to a lot of Caucasians in this country. What does that say to you about the state of things, of race relations and the relationships between law enforcement and African-American families?
It says we got a long ways to go. It says that we have two realities. It says that this is not new to the black community, and this is how we train our kids to cope with it. And it says that our white counterparts are oblivious to it. And because they never have to do it, they're suspicious when we say we do. And so not only is it a difference of reality, but I think it creates the chasm between us and makes the conversations of reconciliation more difficult, because I think our white counterparts are oblivious to it, because that sounds like make-believe. What do you mean 10 and 2? What do you mean you want to call someone while the police are pulling you over? If you've done nothing, just pull over and answer the question. That's never the issue. And being pulled over by the police, I have never been cited. I've never been given a warning that my taillight was out, that my plates were out. When I've been pulled over for what they call suspicious behavior, they let me go once running my plates. But they never gave me a warning because I never did anything wrong in those cases. Now, if I'm speeding, that's different. That's a different situation. But I'm just saying, if in the two times I've been pulled over in Madison within two blocks of my church office, I was never given a warning because I hadn't done anything wrong.
Do you see this as a consciousness-raising moment for us as a nation, a time to claim value and humanity for African-American men in particular?
I think it is. And I wish I could think of a word that's probably stronger than conscious-raising. I think there needs to be a willingness to accept the fact that there are dual realities in this country. And so we need an understanding that would awaken that consciousness. And so, yes, to answer your question, we certainly do. But I don't know. I wish I could. I'm at a loss for words. I wish I could think of something stronger than just conscious awareness building. It's so blatant that I think it's hard for our white counterparts to believe that these realities are true. And they believe in such meritocracy that you cannot be skilled in an upper middle class, an advanced degree, and pulled over just because of your car or your skin. That cannot happen in the United States of America in 2014. So I think that there's some real burying of their heads in the sand regarding this. So I think we need more than just an awakening of consciousness. We need some truth telling. We need some truth serum to say this really is happening. It's overwhelming. We can't fully explain it. But we're tired of pretending like this doesn't happen. It is now too blatant to think that this is just purely coincidental.
Now, as a country, a lot of people would agree that we have been having some tough conversations about race, especially because of President Barack Obama and the questions that his race brought to the surface. Would you say that that is the tip of the iceberg?
I think it's the tip of the iceberg. I think the fear of many African Americans when Barack Obama was elected as our president was that people would, not just the black people, but the white people would sing their version of Kumbaya, that we have overcome and now we have proven that we are a post-racial society. We have all realized that what it's done is unveiled our proclivity to be racist, to be divided, and to hide our racial views in political rhetoric, that we call it political politics, we call it other things, but it has a lot to do with race and ethnicity. And so we have shown that we can have this kind of election in our country, and I'm proud of it. But I think we have all deluded ourselves if we think we no longer have a problem and no longer have to talk about it. That's the setback that I think we've experienced since President Obama's election, that we have somehow accepted this false reality that we have arrived.
What would you like to see happen at this moment in time, or at least begin at this moment in time, so that everyone emerges with greater understanding and compassion and awareness?
I would like to see greater accountability from the governor of Missouri on down. What's the training? What's the accountability? What's the culpability? What does it mean to be put on administrative leave? This officer doesn't want his name shared because he fears profiling. Yet, most black boys in America fear profiling. I want to see people explain how they could have 2/3 of their population be black and only 3 or 4 of their police force black. I want people to say what they were thinking, how this happens on their watch, and how this continues to take place. I don't want to just talk about the black response. I don't want to just talk about what the black community needs. I want white leaders to say, this is inherently wrong. We thought that we were beyond this. We thought that we had hired the best people. We were shocked by this behavior, and it will be dealt with. I think what makes this so difficult is that the average black person has no confidence that this white gentleman will be brought to justice. That's not even in my mind. And if he is duly brought to justice, I'd probably be the first to apologize. I might even actually say it's about time. But there is nothing within my consciousness that is expecting that he will lose his job, lose his pension, and suffer true consequences for his action. That's what makes this so unconscionable for our country. And I want people to address how that can continue to happen on our watch. We saw it in Florida. We saw it with Zimmerman. We're watching this happen. And this brings up all of those old fears. And it just helps us to lose hope, causes us to lose hope for how we move ahead. So I just want some real accountability. And I want someone to say, we're wrong. This is wrong. This is bad. We have messed up, and we're going to gut this department. We're going to gut this administration. We're going to do this right, and we're going to have the community show us and guide us in doing this. This needs to be a radical surgery and not just something that's topical. This is an embarrassment in this day and time that my daughter sends me a text message when I'm at work saying, Daddy, I'm scared. She thinks we stepped back into the 50s, and she's wrong. We stepped back into the 40s.
And we have to leave it there. Dr. G, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we have learned, of course, that the Ferguson authorities have identified the officer involved in the shooting, and we'll continue to watch this story. We've been talking with Dr. Alex G., senior pastor of Fountain of Life Church. He's also the head of the Justified Anger Coalition. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Food Friday. We're taking a look at how to make salads that are hearty enough and yummy enough to be considered entrees. Usually the first thing that comes to mind when you think about a salad entree is something with grilled chicken on it. That's sort of the standard. But Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies, says there are lots of other and better kinds of main course salads. And she's here to share some of them with us. She's been cooking up a storm here at WPR this entire week. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what were you thinking when you were at the starting block here? You wanted to make something that was a salad, had to be hearty, had to be delicious. How did you start?
And considering that when I brought this topic up, about 80% of the respondents immediately said, oh, you mean like a grilled chicken Caesar? It's like, okay, well, obviously we have the green component, the lettuce component, but the first thing people thought of is something with protein added to the greens. So I was starting to develop recipes where protein would be a focus, but I also thought that you needed to have some kind of starch. You needed to have some kind of heft to it, whether it's soba noodles or pasta or potatoes or what we ended up working with, a lot of different grains.
Yeah.
One lovely thing about having grains in your entree salad is this is something that will help you make it ahead of time. It will hold on to however you're dressing it. And then if you want to add more delicate things, you can do that at the end. But a really great thing about an entree salad is it takes a lot of the panic of preparation out of the kitchen. You can do this when you have the time. The other lovely thing is those of us who are grilling now, if you end up grilling just a little bit too much protein, using that extra in an entree salad is a great way to use it up. Have your grains, have some really good veggies, have a nice vinaigrette, and oh, I'm so sorry, we made one extra piece of skirt steak on the grill. I guess we're just going to have to slice it up and put it on the salad.
Well, I think you made some converts to salads around here at WPR, and I'm actually a new convert to smoked trout, but that was the first salad you made, a smoked trout salad, and you've got your grain, you had your wild rice in there. Tell us how that one came together.
This one was really Wisconsin-centric. wild rice, which we get from Wisconsin. I used dried cherries in it, which could come from Door County, but of course dried cranberries would work as well. And then smoked trout. There is one wonderful vendor from Artisan Trout Farms. I talked to her at the farmer's market one Saturday, and she was very excited to think about smoked trout being used in a salad. We toss this with greens and sliced toasted almonds and diced apple. She was very, very specific that when you put this all together, start with your vinaigrette in the bottom of the bowl and then add your stuff on top of it. She says it makes it a lot easier to incorporate everything when the vinaigrette is first.
Oh, really?
And so I tried that, and it did seem to work, so I'm keeping that in mind. This was a salad that used 8 ounces of smoked trout with a cup of wild rice that was then cooked was definitely more than a cup once it got in the bowl. A lot of people told me they found the taste to be very pleasing, but this was a little too light for an entree. I had several people say it'd make a great appetizer, but not everybody was convinced that this was a great entree salad. You mentioned that you really loved it.
I'm sold. Okay. I thought it was delicious. It had the protein. I suppose you could add more smoked trout if you wanted to up that factor of someone suggested croutons.
Or if you want, don't do smoked trout, use salmon. Use, salmon on the grill or salmon that had been poached. There, the pieces of protein can be bigger. And with this, I just used a basic lemon shallot vinaigrette. But somebody said you want to punch it up a little, do a creamy horseradish dressing as well. So that would definitely give it a bit of a kick.
I'm in love with it. I don't want you to change anything. Don't touch it. Don't touch it. Well, and as much as I love that one, I have to say the thing that people were shouting about in the hallways was the salad that you made today. So I want to get to that next.
All right.
This was a salad that doesn't sound very sexy if I just say what's in it, but it really came together and was spectacular. Quinoa lentil salad.
I was inspired to try this from a food blogger in Copenhagen, Sarah Britton. Her blog is called My New Roots, and she had something in there from a couple of years ago called the best lentil salad in the world. And I added a few things, and I took out a few things, and it's a combination of quinoa and French lentils, Dupuis lentils, which cook up a little firmer than others. And firmness is a key with this salad. I put in red onion and carrot, currants and walnuts. And then there was the vinaigrette, which is the spiciest vinaigrette I have ever made. And it was amazing.
What's in it?
Extra virgin olive oil, apple cider vinegar, maple syrup, spicy brown mustard, salt, pepper, cumin, turmeric, coriander, cardamom, cayenne, ground cloves, grated nutmeg, and cinnamon.
I should have said, what isn't in it?
Well, what surprised me, there was no ginger, there was no garlic, which are things that I usually go for in a vinaigrette. This didn't need it. Somebody called it the best salad she'd ever had. I made a huge bowl of this. It could easily feed 6 people as an entree. And she said she could eat the whole bowl.
And it had your quinoa, which is very popular now because it has a lot of protein. Of course, the lentils have protein, and then the goat cheese has protein. So you're really, it felt healthy, and it also felt like it didn't feel like health food. And I have to point out right now that this recipe is up on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm going to be making it soon. I know that for a fact. Did it surpass your expectations,
Lori? Absolutely. This was one where you could do the quinoa and the lentils and the onion and carrot ahead of time. I threw in some chopped arugula, chopped basil, and then, as you mentioned, the goat cheese right at the end, added some extra dressing. And yeah, this was just a party in everybody's mouth. I will throw this out to the Central Time listening audience. If you make this salad and you can come up with a better name than quinoa lentil salad, go ahead and send it in, because we would love to find a great name for this. This is so much fun to eat and so easy to put together.
Right. I think this is a salad that will outlive us all. You've outdone yourself this time, Lori.
Well, I'll definitely be making it this weekend. We've got friends coming over, and I want them to try this.
Good picnic salad?
Absolutely. This is one so easy to do because it can be served at room temperature. You don't have to worry about anything being chilled.
Perfect. Well, Lori, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for all the cooking.
Absolutely.
Spectacular. Spectacular food week here at Wisconsin Public Radio. That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off. Coming up later, the USDA is tweaking its labeling oversight for companies that use the word organic. We'll find out what that could mean for consumers. But first, a new analysis from Oxford Economics finds that American workers don't always use the vacation time they're eligible for. Among people who get paid vacation time, about 4 in 10 workers leave time unused, an average of 8 days a year. Add it up and you get about 429 million vacation days left on the table, more than 1 million years of vacation time abandoned each year. Since August may be the last time to grab some summer vacation, we're listening back to an interview with Al Genie. He's professor of business ethics and chair of the Department of Management at Loyola University, Chicago's Quinlan School of Business. His books include The Importance of Being Lazy in Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacation. Al, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very, very much for having me on. Can I go back and ask you, four in ten, I know that, leave that. So you're suggesting 8 hours a day. How many hours are you suggesting are built up over a year?
8 days a year. Added up, you get 429 million vacation days left on the table in a single year. That's a lot of vacation time that people are not using.
In 1 year, it's true. Well, the statistics that have been out there for a while is that most people don't take their full vacation, and they leave about 5 days on the table, but for all sorts of reasons. And I think the reason part is really critical. That is it family? Is it the pressure of business? Is it economics itself? I mean, since the recession, and my wife and I happily are travelers, there's been a diminishment of tourists and kind of traditional places, even in traditional places, but certainly in a little more exotic places, they've been begging for business left and right because people have been holding back, even if they have some distributive income, afraid of the next drop, so to speak. But I think what's happened is we have become a society of workaholics out of necessity and need, and also out of simple habit, and because we're always afraid that if we miss a day, we could miss a moment.
So we could be left out when the guy or gal down the hall gets a big move and spends time with the boss, and we get left out of the loop.
Absolutely. And I think the American Leave Act suggests that very clearly, that most women do not take the full amount for fear that, you know, the last thing you want to hear after being gone from 12 to 20 weeks on a maternity leave or a family leave is, gee, we're so glad to see you again, but everything's been fine since you've been gone. You know, you don't want to hear that.
You don't want to hear that. Yeah, the place fell apart while you were gone.
Right.
Yeah.
You want exactly so. Or that, my gosh, we realize how much we miss you and needed you, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that those obvious things come in. But I think we've also lost the ability to play. And, you know, I've been thinking about play a lot. And I think, unfortunately, because we work so long, that we think play is anytime we're not working. And that's not true. I think play is something much different than simple leisure or simple relaxation. I think it's the need, you know, this enjoyment, this fun in and of itself, that it's not connected to lifestyle or life needs or life requirements. For the last 40 more or more years, I don't want to admit my age. I was got on public radio, but I'm in my 8th decade. I played handball. And just recently, a group of us have been together for over 35 years. We're all starting to get injured because of age, one thing or another, who's missing and not missing. And what we're lamenting the most is we miss playing. It's not just exercise. And when we look back on it, we started playing handball because it was a quick way to exercise without jogging and, you know, doing aerobics and doing everything. But then we realized what we liked most about it is we were playing. How many men or women still play? And that's what's missing from our vacations. And because we don't know how to play, we very often don't take vacations because we don't know what to do on vacation.
Well, don't you think that it's also in the best interests of, you know, whoever we work for that we're well-rested, happier, less stressed out? Supposedly, you turn in better work when you're all of those things. You take your vacation time and you relax and you play.
Well, I think you're right. I know you're right. All the statistics suggest that people who have a little more leisured time, and people who have more space, people who have downtime, actually come back and are more creative. I actually, on Sundays, because, okay, I'll have to admit this. Hi, I'm Al. I'm a workaholic. On Sundays, I force myself to do no thing that's connected to work. Yes, I'll read, but I won't read anything in the area that I'm working on. I'll read my novel. I'll read something else. But I will not do work, even if I'm dying to do it, because I'm afraid of burning out. I'm afraid of burning up. And I think that everyone knows that. So I feel actually I could do more in the next couple of days because I've been refreshed, recreated, so to speak. But here's the reality. The bosses have the same pushes that the workers have. So they're not recognizing that absolute need as well. And so they're not taking as much vacation, and they're not offering it to their employees, even when it is a good and solid business move.
Well, on the other hand, though, you hear about places who are doing away with vacation time altogether, saying you can take how much vacation you want as long as you get your job done. In fact, you're going to be doing an interview about this next week, the results only workplace movement. So there is that as a counterpoint. But on the other hand, Americans leaving all this time on the table.
But I think that that's a very specialized case. I think we're talking about this new generation of workers, these knowledge workers, who work on these projects that are connected to this computer-based electronic age. We're not talking about surgeons. Surgeons don't work. I do brain surgery on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday, I do therapeutic dance. Friday, I do pottery. And Thursdays, I just veg. That doesn't happen. Those are 24/7 kind of jobs. And I do see, even in the finance industry, so on and so forth, these little movements towards, as long as you get your task done, you could take off. Now, if I remember correctly, some of these places pay you and some don't pay you for the time you're off, but you get paid for the job. So the money incentive is a little different. But how many jobs work that way? You know, how many jobs have? Well, if I get it done by Tuesday, I'm off the rest of the week because I finished my project.
Not many. So does that mean we need the bosses to say, you know what, you guys got to start taking your vacation time and we mean it?
Yes, I think we do. I think that the level of mental health in regard to health itself, maybe Obamacare. And if we're not going to, let's not talk about Obamacare because we'll be just yelling at each other somewhere along the line and getting calls that way. But if one of the thrusts of Obamacare is preventative medicine, not just getting medical attention when you need it. And I think that is more recreation, more physical activity, more exercise, better eating, et cetera, but more recreation. I wonder, you know, the nursing industry for a number of years has been doing the 3 to 4 week. 4 day week, that is, you get 40 hours in 3 days or 40 hours in 4 days, and you have a 3 day weekend or 3 days off because I think they rotate. I don't see why that's not possible for many of us, all of us. I know universities for a while, but now they're not doing it for other kinds of financial reasons, had Fridays off. That was a study day. Now, academics were expected to be in their office, the professors, but they were supposed to be reading or studying, not necessarily, you know, doing the regular part of the job. I think we can restructure work to give us more time, but I think we're also creatures of habit. We're also afraid of what that might mean. We're also afraid of losing time, losing status, and losing stuff.
Do you think we're also maybe getting too much of our personal self-worth from work, that we're not spending enough time developing relationships, and instead, you know, all of our carrots from the universe are coming from work?
I like all your carrots in the universe. I'll take two bunches of these. Before I wrote The Importance of Being Lazy, I wrote a book called My Job Myself, which exactly argues that, good or bad, we get our identity from our jobs. And if we're lucky, we have good work, we have good identity, and we feel good about ourselves. If we have bad work, we still get our identity, and we don't feel so good about ourselves. I think we do. You know, think about it. You go to a meeting, and we used to call them, you know, smokers. That we don't do that anymore. and or make it a meeting of men initially. It isn't. You don't walk through the room and hear people say, "Hi, I have three children, or I'm a hang glider fanatic, or I love to jog, or I collect bees, or I collect stamps." You hear name, rank, and serial number. "Hi, my name's Bill. I'm a, you know, a divorce attorney. I'm a this. I'm a that. I'm a, you know." We brand ourselves by our job labels, and we get identity from our job.
We're listening back to an interview with business ethics professor Al Genie. He's the author of The Importance of Being Lazy. We're talking about American attitudes towards vacation and leisure and a study that showed that we leave 429 million vacation days on the table each year. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to an encore of our conversation with business professor Al Genie. He's the author of The Importance of Being Lazy. As August whizzes by and Americans are choosing whether or not to stay on the clock or to take a vacation, we're talking about work and leisure in the United States. A recent study shows that we leave millions of unpaid vacation hours on the table each year. And we'll go to our phones now and take a call from Guy. Guy, what's on your mind?
Hi, one of the things I think could be happening is that people are afraid of losing their jobs, especially in the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. If somebody has, 3 weeks of vacation, but they don't use it all, but somebody else does and they do use it all, and then it comes around time for layoffs and it says, "Hey, Joe never took all of his vacation last year, but John did. He's being more productive and staying here more at work where we perceive things being more important. He's the one that's going to stay, and the other gentleman's going to be the one that gets laid off."
Right. Yeah. Really interesting point, Guy. Thanks for that. And Al, what do you think about that? That seems like a real concern that someone might get penalized for taking their vacation time.
It is a real concern. And I think every difference does make a difference when you got to make a tough call at work. And even though you don't want to be partial or unfair, of course that's going to make a difference. See, he took his vacation. Can I depend on this person as much as this person? All other things being equal, that may push it over. But I think that is a valid point to bring up. But I think there's a larger issue here. I think this is more of a cultural pattern, a multifaceted cultural pattern than a single cause. If we could, if it was a single cause, we could get it or get close to it, we could eradicate it. But it is this multiple reasons, economic, sociological. People are simply workaholics in the worst sense. Don't forget, workaholism for some people is an honorific, something they brag about. But also it's a way of coping with life when you can't deal with it in any other way. If I stay busy, at least I'm not depressed. So I wish there was a single answer and that I could write that book and give that answer and become more than a professor and be a guru along the way. But I do think it's multifaceted.
And we're going to go next. By the way, thank you for that call, Guy. We're going to go to Ryan in Milwaukee. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So my problem is I'm a multi-unit retail manager, and it's not that we aren't given the opportunity to take time off or that we have to be concerned for our jobs. It's more that it's so difficult for us to take time off. We have so many restrictions on when we can use the days or, the proper coverage that we have. So I just wondered if we had any suggestions for that.
Yeah, that's really a tough one. And the analogy here is when you own your own small business. Every time you're not at work, you're not making money, especially if you don't have other help or it's two or three family, person family business. When do you take off? When is downtime, et cetera, et cetera? And I think that's also the problem of a lot of professional people. I mentioned surgeons before. We found out that in various areas of medicine that people aren't going into the more glamorous areas because it means a complete abdication of free time, an abdication of your own ability, even if you are in a partnership or if three or four people are doing the surgery, that more and more, especially women, are going into fields that they can go into clinical, a dermatologist, et cetera, et cetera, where they're not always on call and they don't have to be there. Unfortunately, I think that the example you're bringing up is job specific. And, and you can't be, can you close your restaurant at Christmas time? It sounds like madness. Do you close a retail store at Christmas time, et cetera, et cetera? The answer is no. And so I think there are jobs that simply require us to be there on a regular basis. And people find it very difficult to carve out a private life because of that.
So, Al, does this make it especially hard for families and especially hard for women if we are being punished when we take vacation time?
Well, it's hard for women because, unfortunately, even though women now represent 51% of the workforce, and even though women are now climbing up in the various executive positions, et cetera, women still have are one down in the workplace. And every time a woman makes a mistake, it's what the former female mayor of Chicago said, Jane Burns. When I make a mistake, they don't say, "Oh, that darn mayor made a mistake." Oh, that darn woman made a mistake, right? Mm. So she always had to be three times better, which I still think is the ratio that women talk about now in the professions. You have to be three times better than your male surgeon, three times better than your male co-pilot, et cetera, et cetera. I think women suffer from this a great deal as well. A woman I interviewed for one of my books said to me, "I don't know what I feel bad about more. The kids, every time I miss a function," she was working full-time plus, "every time I miss a function at school, I know I've missed it and it won't come back again. The job, which I can never, ever get enough time to finish it. This house, which we had to buy, but now we sleep in, we don't really live in. Or my husband, whatever his name is." And I think this problem is more poignant for women because, again, they dare not make a mistake. But I think it is a cross-cultural problem.
And let's go back to the calls. Let's see. Justin is next. We're going to take his call from Milwaukee. Hi, Justin.
Hi. It speaks very well to my point. I work for a very competitive employer in the Milwaukee area. I have a college degree, but my employer simply gives us 3 weeks of vacation time, but then makes it very hard for us to take it by allowing no flexibility, no coverage, no extra person to pick up the slack when someone wants to take a week off. And I know that, for example, I had a child last year and I was entitled to 2 weeks of paid paternity leave. I never took it because I knew if I took that 2 weeks, it was going to be 6 months for me to dig out of that pool. Couldn't see myself doing it.
Right. Thanks a lot, Justin. And just to describe that same kind of scenario, kind of like frequent flyer miles that you can't use.
Right. And I think that Justin's brought up a really wonderful point. When firms say we give you 2 or 3 weeks, do they set up an internal support mechanism by which you could actually do that? My wife, I'm in a mixed marriage, by the way. My wife is a lawyer and a Republican. That's my standard line. But she gets 4 to 5 weeks off, but the firm works around that. It is an established cultural part of this. Now, she's in a boutique firm that is under 200 lawyers in Chicago. That's kind of small. But they actually set up mechanisms by which that can happen. Now, the truth is she could rarely take five. It takes about 2 years' notice to take five at once. But she does take all of her time. And in one of those lumps, it's 3 weeks where we go on our major vacation during the year. But that's because there are mechanisms in the firm. You could say you get 3 weeks off if you can fit it into your schedule or fit it into the needs of the company. Well, that's a formula for failure.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Justin, and good luck to you. And we're going to move to Nick in Sussex. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What do you think?
I guess I just kind of had a kind of not necessarily totally on the topic, but I'm an Army reservist, and I do construction in the Army, whereas my civilian job is in an office. So when I go do my once a month or 2, 3, 4 weeks out of the year to go do laborious work, I come back and do my office job and sit at a desk and my computer all day, and I feel quite refreshed having that kind of opposite sort of work once in a while.
So that's kind of a vacation, it sounds like, to you, toggling between two very different jobs and a lot to juggle, too, on the other hand. What do you think, Al?
Well, I think this is like cross-training. I'm getting old and I'm too lazy to do it myself, I have a trainer 2 days a week. And the trick is, he works me like a dog, but never does the same thing every day, so I'm not totally bored by it, and it winds up being refreshing. I think that it's all about timing, timing, timing. Think about this. What's your favorite food? Then think about eating that food three meals a day, 7 days a week, ad infinitum. It's soon not your favorite food. I think breaking it up, even, and it comes to the Latin word divertio, to be diverted from, or divertirsi, in Italian, to do something different always adds a little spice to the job. So even something like doing a different job for a while may be a good idea. In fact, the famous model for that, of course, I think is Volvo, who years ago trained a person to do a number of jobs and also trained their partner to do a number of jobs so that you not only could do many jobs on the line, that you could job share with your partner. But that's a very, again, complicated cultural arrangement that takes a great deal of time, money, and effort.
Al, do you see this problem we're talking about, people not taking their vacation, being too invested in their job or too scared to go? Is this an American phenomenon? It seems like the Germans are pretty good at taking vacation,
yeah.
Or at least so I hear. Are there things that we could learn from them?
I think in Germany you start off with 3.2 weeks. I think you start off with over 3 weeks a year as guaranteed on every job. I think that was true. When I wrote to my job, The Importance of Being Lazy, I'm sorry, those statistics were true. The Germans had the highest number than the Swedes, Swedes and so on and so forth. But where, you know, the Americanization of the world is occurring, and because of tough economic times, they too are crunching that. Don't forget the French, one of the elections we're fighting about, they had gone to 35 hours. Well, they're back to 42. The Italians have increased the workloads here and there. So I think it's happening across the world, a little slower, and they're still fighting it in a very real sense. But it is, I think, a problem all over. We're in China this time last summer, and that was a problem in China, that when do we get off? We have now this wealth and this extra income, but we don't have time to spend it. An interesting problem indeed.
All right, Al, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
I appreciate being with you.
Al Genie is a professor of business ethics and chair of the Department of Management at Loyola University, Chicago's Quinlan School of Business. His books include The Importance of Being Lazy and Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacation.